This is the State of Things broadcasting from the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. I'm Frank Stacio. And now it's time to learn about monsters. Have you ever wondered about the origin of vampires?
I vowed to suck your blood.
Or how about those undead creatures, zombies? Maybe you've speculated on the real-world story behind witches. Well, whichever is your favorite, Roland Kays can tell you a little bit about where they came from and how they got stuck in our imagination. Kays is the director of the Biodiversity and Earth Observation Lab at the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Let's start with a vampire now. There is an actual scientific explanation for what people were seeing and how this whole myth got started.
Well, there's some ideas behind it. I think evolutionary biologists, which is what I am, we're always looking at the origins of things and where things started. And we look then, you know, what goes on before that. And so that kind of got me started thinking about during the Halloween times, we have these different myths and where do they actually come from? And there's actually a really fun quote from Mary Shelley that I think kind of gets the spirit of this. And Mary Shelley, of course, is the author of Frankenstein. And she says, "Everything must have a beginning, and that beginning must be linked to something that went before." And so when we think today about our myths about zombies or witches or vampires, they have, you know, like, for example, the vampires today have a totally different sort of a story than they had originally. And we look back, we can trace the literature back to Bram Stoker and Count Dracula. And what were the original things that he sort of captured? And he himself was pulling together different parts of culture in Eastern Europe in sort of the 1800s. And there was a disease that was affecting the people in Europe at that time called pellagra. And there's a number of symptoms of this disease that are actually very similar to what is sort of the stereotypical Dracula vampire characteristics that Bram Stoker talked about. And so we think that there's some idea that this disease was actually some of the inspiration for that.
And what is the disease?
Pellagra comes from a simple vitamin deficiency, from not having enough niacin. And so people at this time of our history were not eating a well-rounded diet, and so they weren't getting enough niacin. And some of the symptoms are they become very sensitive to the sun, and their skin, actually, if exposed to the sun, the skin can get scaly and then get really, really paper thin and white. And so they avoid the sun. Their lips will crack and their gums will recede, and so their teeth will kind of stick out, and they'll have this sort of red, you know, blood on their lips.
And bigger teeth, right?
And especially bigger teeth. They'll waste away. They can have internal hemorrhaging, and they won't want to eat. And they'll kind of waste away. They'll have diarrhea and get really skinny. And then just to top it off, they go psychotic.
So here is at least some physical manifestations. The story itself must have been, I mean, the idea of things sort of being demonic and possessed by the powers of night. I mean, certainly those stories circulated probably as long as we were telling stories,
sure.
Right?
Yeah. And they you know, there have been myths of vampires going back, you know, well before that. But the Count Dracula was kind of the first time this was really put into paper and pulled together a lot of these items that now a lot of these sort of characteristics that are still, you know, used today in whatever sort of teen vampire movie or bunicula or whatever, they still sort of have some of these. But it's fun also as a scientist to look back, well, why was pellagra such an issue then? And if you look at the history of the people and what they were eating, this is around the time when corn first arrived into the old world. So corn is a new world crop. It was domesticated and it was evolved and selected for by the Aztecs and the Mayans and all the new world societies. And it made its way over to the old world and was a bonanza of calories. It's a great crop. But interestingly, it's not, if not prepared right, it's not a well-rounded food. And so the Americans had evolved a recipe that involved treating it with kind of a lye solution that would actually make niacin bioavailable. So there is niacin in corn, but if you don't treat it, you won't get it. So the Europeans had been already living off of all these grains, wheat and rye and other things. And so they had these big mills. They grew the corn. They just chucked it in the mill and ground it up and ate it. But they weren't getting the niacin. And so in Eastern Europe, if you were really poor and you didn't have much else to eat, you might be eating a lot of corn porridge, and you sort of, you know, you got the corn from the New World, but you didn't get the right recipe, and that's why pellagra was such a problem.
So food processing goes way back. Knowing how to do it right is very important. Well, why Eastern Europe and not Western Europe? Were they adding the niacin or using?
No, I mean, it was a problem throughout the area, but it was also a problem in, you know, where this sort of some of the rest of these parts of Dracula were coming together at the same time. There were a lot of these people that were going crazy, were sensitive to the sun, were looked like they were bleeding at the lips, and so, you know, you would have been seeing these people that were horribly sick, and that would be something that would have been familiar to the rest of the people that you're writing the story for as well. And so I think that's sort of, you know, why some of those elements got incorporated into the myth of Dracula.
And that's what gets back to Mary Shelley's quote, in a sense, because we are story makers, and we as humans and our consciousness makes a beginning, a middle, and end. She's conscious of the fact that there may be ways in which these stories are larger than our capacity. But if we're making the story, then we're going to say that illness, that face, demon. Aha, I've got it.
Right.
I've got
exactly.
An answer. And then along come you scientists. And no, it's very, really fascinating stuff to think about the ways in which these colonization, the moving of corn back and forth, whether or not you knew how to process it, all plays a part in these
great
myths.
Well, it's interesting because, like you said, there were other parts of Europe that were suffering from pellagra as well, and it didn't necessarily work its way into their myths. So there are different, you know, different times in history where different elements are coming together, and it's always an interaction between human culture and biology and the food that we're eating and the environment that we're in. And sometimes those interact in different ways, and sometimes they interact in these ways that generate these powerful stories and myths that sort of stick with us over millennia.
The undead, the story that will not die. You know, and one of the fascinating things to me is the way the myths about the myths get going. I mean, I've also heard stories about the plague itself where people were buried very quickly because of the fear of contamination from the plague, sometimes too quickly. And so if you were to unearth a casket of someone who hadn't quite been dead when they were buried, you might see scratch marks and sort of evidence of life within the casket.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was actually a big part of the Dracula myth, especially originally. It sort of had these zombie aspects to it. And people were worried about the undead, and Dracula was sort of the undead. And so sort of some of what we think today of the zombies was part because, like you said, people were getting buried alive, literally. And there are inventions, there are patents for these amazing inventions of little bells that you can ring from inside your casket that are rigged up above your cemetery so that you can buy that and you can pay someone to put that in there. Just in case you happen to get buried alive, you'll be able to let someone know so they can dig you out.
Fascinating stuff. Well, we talked about zombies. Now, that's a West African tradition that makes its way to Haiti. Tell us how zombies got going.
Yeah, sure. So zombies, again, today have taken on, you know, quite a different different sort of aura and mythology, but a lot of it started with the Haitian zombies and the Haitian voodoo, and this is, as you mentioned, a culture that came from Africa. Lots of different slave cultures that were, you know, slaves that were brought from different cultures in Africa to Haiti. They escaped into the mountains and formed, you know, this really interesting hybrid culture of all these different African traditions, voodoo culture, and a lot of these small villages had this voodoo religion that's very important to them, and these sort of secret societies that would, to a large extent, police themselves. So when there were problems in the villages between individuals, they would deal with it themselves rather than, you know, within their religion and within their secret societies, rather than try to get the government involved or the police or something like that. And so there were and the witch doctors were sort of the judge in this case. And depending on how bad of a person you were, you would get different punishments doled out. And the sort of ultimate punishment was they would turn you into a zombie.
And how would they do that?
Well, they would do it just like you would imagine that a Haitian witch doctor would. He would put together a potion, and they would poison you. And what's amazing is that some scientists have gone and actually tracked down some of the ingredients in these recipes. And they've tracked down some people that have really gone through this experience. So it has some factual basis behind it. Not a lot of evidence for it, but there is. There's a guy named Clarvius Naris who, this apparently happened to. And they give you this poison. And the key ingredient of the poison is pufferfish. And pufferfish is an animal that can puff up and sort of be spiny, but it also has this really strong tetrodotoxin poison. And interestingly, this same fish is eaten in Japan as fugu. And there's a whole, you know, totally different culture, totally different way that this ingredient has incorporated into their society.
Well, isn't that the dish where you have to be very careful to extract the gland that
you do? Yeah, you have to be like a licensed chef to prepare this. And there are examples where Japanese fishermen have eaten it without being careful enough, and some of them have died, but others of them have been pronounced dead by a doctor. Only to realize that they actually weren't. So it puts you in such a deep coma. And that's what the witch doctors are counting on. They're going to put you into this coma. You're going to be pronounced dead by a doctor. We'll say you're dead. And you're going to be still conscious, actually. So you will watch yourself be lowered into a coffin, be, you know, sort of carried through town in this funeral, and be buried in the ground. You might be wondering if you are dead or not, but you can't move. You're paralyzed by this toxin. After a couple of days, the toxin wears off, but you're stuck in a coffin. The witch doctor comes back with a couple henchmen, and they dig you out in the middle of the night, and they beat the crap out of you because you're pretty mad at them. So there's usually a fight breaks out. That's why they bring their henchmen along. But then there's a second part to this, and they feed you this this paste made from a plant that's locally called zombie cucumber. That's how it's known all over Haiti, and it's a datura plant, and it's got another toxin in it, and that keeps you in a sort of zombified, stupefied state longer term. And basically at this point, they ship you off to the side of the island. They put you to work in the sugarcane fields, and you're, you know, never to return to your hometown where everyone thinks you're dead. And that's, I guess, normally what would happen. But in one case, this guy, Clavius Naris, you know, somehow snapped out of it or stopped eating his zombie cucumber paste and wandered back to his old village. And they weren't actually very happy to see him.
Would the cucumber paste have that effect without the sort of the puffer fish?
Yeah, yeah, they're two independent toxins.
But then they use something else to bring you out of the puffer fish coma.
Well, or the puffer fish, wears off. Or you die. I mean, that's the tricky part is how does the witch doctor get you the right amount of puffer fish toxin? And sometimes I imagine it's probably a bit of an overdose.
Yeah, they start you with a low dose, and then they have you come back in 2 weeks, and they do a blood test, see how you're doing. But part of this was much of this used, including the ingredients. Did much of that come from West Africa or Africa, or were these all sort of native?
Pufferfish are a worldwide species, so they could have been, and that's not something that we really know. You know, a lot of the Haitian traditions and the voodoo culture is still very secret and not hasn't been subject to the sort of microscope of science as much as and maybe that's okay.
The cultural connection here too is if you are enslaved people and you're doing work for somebody else, there's a point at which you have to, you know, in a sense, be a zombie. You have to put your body to it because you're forced. On the other hand, your mind might be something else, and that's a kind of a cultural connection in all of this.
Yeah,
as
sure.
Well,
you can see why this may have the pufferfish toxin sort of worked its way into the society totally different in Haiti than it did in Japan.
All right, let's turn to witches now. It turns out the Salem witch trials and the hippie generation probably have something in common.
Yeah, so there's an interesting story here, and it involves another food and another type of poisoning, and it involves it sort of brought in some ways to its climax in the Salem witch trials. But there's evidence that it was going on for hundreds of years before that in France and in England and in some of the older witch trials as well. And this is connected with a fungus that grows on rye. So rye is a grain that's been grown for a long time, a domesticated crop, and there's a fungus called ergot that will grow on it, and it grows more in wet years. And so if you look back at the history of witch trials in Europe and rainfall, there's this correlation, which is why we think it may have been a long-term cause. And so ergot is this fungus, and for a long time, people didn't realize it wasn't part of the plant. They thought that sometimes rye grain has this black grain, and so they would just eat it. They wouldn't pick it off. And it turns out that this ergot, this fungus, has psychoactive properties and, in fact, is what LSD was derived from. And it also has a lot of other really nasty side effects that make you really sick. And it's a disease known as ergot poisoning. And so Salem witch trials occurred in a very wet year, and these people were eating the rye grain, ingesting the ergot. They were having all sorts of really bad itches, and your fingers kind of go gangrene, and you have some of these bodily problems, but you're also tripping out. And it's not just the accused witches that were tripping out, but some of, you know, the whole community probably was having some of these side effects. And I think the other thing, there are scholars certainly who know more about the societal aspects of the Salem witch trials than I do, but certainly there was a lot of sort of what it boils down to is small town politics that were going on at the same time. And so again, just like in some of these other examples, you have this biochemical, sort of biological, you know, things that are going on, but they're integrating in with whatever the local culture is. And in this case, the sort of, you know, real small, localized, small village types of politics that were going on and that sort of all fed into this horrible storm.
Well, and it's even bigger than that because it wasn't just in Salem and it wasn't just in North America. The same things were happening in Europe. And as you said, this goes back for hundreds of years where whole villages were – there are records of people kind of tripping out and nobody quite knew why. And
right.
They
so they, you know, they would sort of accuse – they would see a woman do something crazy and they'd say, oh, well, she must be a witch. And, you know, maybe they really saw that, or maybe she was doing something really, you know, maybe she was itching, you know, a lot, or trying to pull her finger off or something because it hurt so bad. And just sort of, you know, so it all fed into this.
Well, that's the other thing, is that men and women were affected equally, but women were burned at the stake and pitched into the lakes. And so this also coincides with big transformations in both social and economic forces that are transforming Europe, and then it leads to colonization. And it turns out that women are going to bear the brunt of this because they held a role that now we have to sort of discipline those women. And so making them witches when they turn green. And the guys apparently were elected aldermen because of their passion. Who knew?
Right, exactly. The sort of larger sex, they're taking advantage of their physical dominance in that case.
Is there any – so, and tell me more about Urgot. Now, what's the relationship between it and Rye? I mean, is there some kind
it's
of –
It's a parasite.
It's a parasite.
Yeah, it's just straight up parasite of the rye grain that grows. And you know, one of the interesting questions is to ask, well, why do these plants and animals have these toxins in the first place? And sometimes it's pretty obvious. The pufferfish, you know, has this toxin because it doesn't want to be eaten. And that frees it up to live a totally different life. It doesn't have to try to escape from fish because fish know just not
well,
to eat.
Let me stop you there. How do they know that? This is the key to me, is like if you're going to kill the unwise fish who ate me, but then he's gone and the next guy, how do they know not to eat?
Well, this is natural selection through evolution. The animals that realize that a fish that puffs up and has spikes is something you shouldn't eat, those are the ones that are going to survive and pass their genes on, and the ones that eat it will not. So there has to be a signal, you know, from the animal who's poisoned as well. And often, you know, this leads to some really amazing stories about mimicry, you know, made famous with the monarch butterfly, which is poisonous, and the viceroy butterfly, which is not, but looks really similar, because animals have just evolved to avoid a butterfly that looks like a monarch. And so the viceroy is taking advantage of it without having – often these poisons are very, very energetically expensive to make, physiologically expensive. So, you know, the animals need to have the sort of internal machinery to make it and eat all the right foods and everything like that. Whereas the viceroy, he just gets to live, you know, for free off of that impression.
Urgot, is it so? Now, what's the function of Urgot? Because if it is a parasite, but it also has this toxin,
it also doesn't want to get eaten. You know, especially before it reaches its phase of being reproductive. There's another interesting example of this with, for example, capsaicin and hot peppers. Why are peppers hot? What's the advantage of the plant to being hot? And what we found is that mammals taste capsaicin, rats, and they avoid the heat, but birds do not. And it turns out these plants, the pepper plants, they want the birds to eat the fruit and spread the seeds around. But they don't want the rodents to come up because the rodents will chew right through the seeds with their incisors. So they've got this amazing chemical that they've evolved for the purpose of promoting their seeds to be dispersed by birds and not by mammals. And this, of course, is something that we've captured on and said, wow, this tastes kind of good, and we've selected it like crazy. Now you have these peppers that are, you know, so hot that they're just insane. That's all through, you know, us sort of taking that natural variation and selecting it to crazy extremes.
To a crazy extreme, so nature didn't count on the enchilada. That's what you're saying.
Right.
Roland, thank you so much for being on the program.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Roland Kays, Director of Biodiversity and Earth Observation Lab at the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Just ahead, millions of reasons to love bats on the State of Things. Please stay with us.